This is Melissa, and it is the first day of June 2025. And I hope that you are all doing well. I wanted to just say right off the bat, with this talk that I've chosen, I noticed that Alan was reminding you to donate and also to order the books, and he said they're written in a nonlinear fashion, and he explained why this was a good thing and how it helped you use your mind differently. And then he told you all of the different ways that you could support his work. And I don't do that often enough, but I need to. And so I am going to let you know that I have a very large stack of the flash drives, the USBs that I had done late last year. I still have a healthy pile of those. And it pleases me to sell them one at a time or as the whole collection. And for those of you who have heard me do the math before, this is a huge savings for you. It allows you to have all of Alan Watt's audios, except all of them actually, and a couple of videos, and then guest video appearances, and that's pretty much it. Everything except his books is on these flash drives, plus some extras that, not his books, but some PDFs of other books, some articles, Alan's guitar music from the Christmas compositions that he did are on there as well. So that's one way that you can support what I'm doing. And there are also Alan's books, and they're just the old-fashioned CD form of the audios. It is a savings, though, if you do the math to get the USBs. And I have just started a Substack, and this will allow you to subscribe to that in a monthly or yearly subscription plan. And so far, it's been up for 10 days, and I haven't put anything up for paid subscribers only, but I am going to do that soon. There will, first of all, be a book club video that is going up in the paid section, and I think there's going to be some other things there too. So I've had, so far, a contributor to the time capsule idea, and those are little snippets or things inspired from Alan's long talks that he gave us between February of 2020 and late February of 2021. And that is Cutting Through the Matrix, cuttingthroughthematrix.substack.com. So that is my sincere asking you to support what I'm doing, and for those of you who do, I greatly appreciate it. It's just so wonderful that I can do this, that I can find different ways to bring Alan's work to you, add my own contributions, and it's just great. Thank you. I appreciate it. Now, those of you who are into pattern recognition, you are going to know, because I've said it one time too many, that I'm sort of a last-minute person. I have been advised to plan ahead and put some episodes in the can, and boy, that's good advice. But I go last minute, and so here I am on a Saturday evening once again. But I think part of the problem, you know, Alan would joke about why he liked to, you know, when he was doing the blurbs and no longer on RBN radio, he would just do this and that and the other before he would sit down to record. And the joke that he would make is, you never know what's going to happen in the world that needs some kind of commentary. Also, he was just thinking about things or looking at something or watching a video or reading an article. And all of that would swim around in his mind until he was ready to talk. And I'm not comparing myself to Alan, but I am saying I picked up some of his work habits. So anyway, one thing that I did today was I was in the Waiting for the Miracle book club chat that was unrecorded over at Telegram. And we had said, we'll go for about an hour and a half. And at a little over 2 hours of a really interesting conversation, I said, well, I have to go. I've got to do some other things. And I did. I was looking for some articles to put up for this Redux. I was actually looking for what Redux it was going to be, which one of the audios, because I have a tendency, again, for the pattern recognizers out there of listening and discarding and listening and discarding, and then boom, something hits me. And so that's what I was doing. And then I looked down and I saw that the chat was still going on. This was about 3 hours later. And so I got back on and listened to a bit of the conversation, which was really interesting, and made a couple of comments. And so this ties in to the Redux that I ultimately picked, because Telegram is social media, and it is a digital platform that collects data, and for which you have to tie it to your cell phone. I don't use my phone for that purpose, but play it off of the computer. But I'm not kidding myself here. I know what's going on. And I don't see anyone's face that is on that chat. And some of them remain strangers to me. Some of the people who are participating, I have had conversations with on, in other media. And I know what you look like, and I know the sound of your voice, and I can put your voice with your name. But the point that I want to make is that in spite of the fact that it's a double-edged sword, right? That's it. It's a double-edged sword, because this conversation in the book club chat was engaging, thought-provoking. It was everything that you would want a conversation to be, and it was happening online in the digital world. And I've participated in a few of these that weren't so welcoming, thought-provoking, stimulating, engaging. So I know what's out there, but this was pretty wonderful. And that really, that idea ties in with the Redux, because we live in a complicated world when we leave the confines of our own mind and venture out, and it has been made more complicated by design. And we are also, as Alan pointed out, for 2.5 decades or longer, really, we are at the end of an age going into a new age, the new age. And so much goes along with that transition from one age to another. Someone sent me via email yesterday a link to part two of a Truth Stream Media, that is Aaron and Melissa Dykes, a Truth Stream Media video. And I started to listen to it, watch it, and it was good. They do good work. And I mentioned that in the chat today, and Nick Hayes had actually seen the first part of it and was giving a backstory and the names of some of the players and why that was important. And I am going to recommend it. I have not finished it yet, but it is thought-provoking and it's worth hearing. And so, again, I had kind of thought, well, I'd go a different way with the Redux, but I wanted to talk about not just technology, not just a kind of a Luddite, you know, technology bad, scary, what's happening, surveillance, but more the fact of it, where we are. Now, you can opt out altogether. And I made a point recently in a recording that that's what Prince, how he proceeds with the computer. And I'll just say he's one wise man. But for those of us who are walking the razor's edge for one reason or another, I think caution is advisable. So these videos, but from TrueStream Media, the first is how the ELISA effect is being used to game humanity. And the second is the ELISA effect 2, Electric Idiocracy Zombie Apocalypse Boogaloo, which Melissa said that she just wanted to get Zombie Apocalypse Boogaloo into a title, and she did, and it pleased her. The ELISA effect gets its name from ELISA, which was the first chat. You know, we've got, you know, ChatGPT and Grok, and ELISA goes all the way back to 1966. And I'll just read you a little bit about it. It's an early natural language processing computer program developed from 1964 to 1967 at MIT by Joseph Weizenbaum, created to explore communication between humans and machines. ELISA simulated conversation by using a pattern matching and substitution methodology that gave users an illusion of understanding on the part of the program, but had no representation that could be considered really understanding what was being said by either party. Now, some of you might remember that some months back, I read part of a letter from a listener, and he was talking about loneliness and isolation of waking up to this information, this knowledge, and that it simply eliminated a number of people in your life that you could actually talk to. And I thought that was sad. And when I was watching the second part of this from TrueStream Media, the idea that people were engaging or, you know, trying to have a relationship with their chat medium, whether it's ChatGPT or whatever they're using, is a real thing out there, and not just the feeling that they're being understood and that, you know, this is listening. And what Melissa Dykes said was that she had seen the movie Her, which predicts this when it first came out. I think it's been about 13 years now. And but now she sees that movie with a, you know, whole different understanding of what this means when people are seeking primary relationships with artificial intelligence. So that was really what was on my mind. And then another thing had popped up for me yesterday when my brother mentioned to me that Peter Thiel had been given a write-up in the New York Times. And I wouldn't say so much a write-up, like a favorable piece of PR, but, you know, kind of one of those scary scenario things. And the headline, because after he mentioned it to me, I had to go check it out, and I went down several avenues of research and thinking about this last night. And I'll share some of that if I have time. Trump taps Palantir to compile data on Americans. The Trump administration has expanded Palantir's work with the government, spreading the company's technology, which could easily merge data on Americans throughout agencies. Okay, one other thing that happened this week is that Elon Musk said he's going away from his Doge work and he's got to concentrate on his companies. And there was some, it might have also been from the New York Times, but one of the papers said, oh, and his drug use is out of control. So we're watching this play. I saw from another source that Musk was never anything more than an advisor. He was not really actively employed by Doge. But so the timing of this is interesting. So Musk announces that, and pretty much the same day, Trump taps Palantir to compile data on Americans. Now, I have mentioned Palantir before. I have told you what it is, that it's something that was funded by Peter Thiel, that he's bankrolled it and is still involved in it. And who the CEO is, that's Alex Karp, as I like to call him sometimes, Alex Creep. And Palantir comes, it's the Seeing Stones from the Lord of the Rings movie. So, you know, we get it, okay? The Seeing Stones allow them to see all there is to know about us. And I had mentioned before that on Unlimited Hangout, this is an article from Max Jones. I don't have in front of me, I know Whitney Webb also wrote a couple of articles about Palantir. I didn't see them immediately, but this is one from January of this year. The CDC, Palantir, and the AI Healthcare Revolution. The CDC Center for Forecasting and Outbreak Analytics has partnered with the CIA-linked Palantir to cement the public-private model of invasive surveillance and public health, all while pushing the U.S. national security state and Silicon Valley even closer together. The Pentagon and Silicon Valley are in the midst of cultivating an even closer relationship as the Department of Defense and big tech companies seek to jointly transform the American healthcare system into one that is artificial intelligence or AI driven. The alleged advantages of such a system espoused by the Army itself, big tech and pharma executives, as well as intelligence officers, would be unleashed by the rapidly developing power of so-called predictive medicine, or a branch of medicine that aims to identify patients at risk of developing a disease, thereby enabling either prevention or early treatment of that disease. I'll just link to that and you can read it. But backing up as to how my brother ended up mentioning the article, I have been, you know, going on the go, and I haven't really given myself in literally months that checkout thing that I like to do, which is something, you know, Alan liked to check out pretty much every day with something that he was reading that wasn't directly related to a piece of research or watching a movie for the second time or watching a movie for the third time. He was good about checking out, and me on my own, not so much. But every once in a while, some part of my body, psyche, emotions reminds me to check out. And so last night, I was home alone and I checked out with a movie from 30 years ago that I thought I had seen, but as it turned out, I had not seen it. And that was called The Net, starring Sandra Bullock and others. It's called an action thriller film. In the film, a systems analyst, and they like to tell us over and over, she's a hacker, with few personal contacts, learns that all records about her life have been deleted, that her house has also been emptied, and she must now find a way to reclaim her original identity. And one of the things that was interesting about this is that the movie was made in 1995, and the book that I just finished reading to talk about next week with Nick Hayes, Snow Crash, was written, I think, in 92 or 93. And the language, the ideas in both of them, the fact that hackers are just so darn cool, the sense that I was in the same era with them, the movie and that book, really came through for me. But one of the things that struck me was that the setup is there is some kind of politician, congressman, as it turns out, I looked it up, he's the Undersecretary of Defense, commits suicide after being informed that he has tested positive for HIV. So what we later learn in the movie is that in real time, you know, this hacking program that's been designed, it can just basically go in and take your medical records and falsify them right there in real time. And one of the other characters in the movie ends up dying in the hospital because it's got him down listed instead of what he came in for. It's got him listed as a diabetic. He's given the wrong medicine, and that's that. But this is all ringing a bell. Like, I've seen this movie, not that movie, but, you know, I've just seen this again and again, this kind of real time. And it's always the setup is the same. There's some kind of counterterrorism bill or something that we need for our security, because, right, that's how it's always sold. It's to keep us safe and secure and keep the bad guys at bay. And, you know, so there might be a politician and he's corrupt. Oh, wow, that's shocking. And he's in collusion with some private business, some firm. And so this is what they're doing. And you've got the same thing in Enemy of the State. And Enemy of the State was a 1998 movie that was one that Alan Watt had recommended to us on one of his talks a time or two. And I actually watched this one on his recommendation before I ever spoke with him or knew him. But I was listening to him, obviously. And I was just kind of freaked out because it all felt not hypothetical at all, but very real. I mean, to my mind, it's like, of course, that's what this technology is doing. Of course, this is where they're taking us, or we're already here. And then a couple of other movies that I saw with Alan, one was called The Echelon Conspiracy. Same setup, politician, NSA, monitoring, selling this surveillance program to the government. Eagle Eye was another one. I think both Echelon Conspiracy, that was, they say, 2009, and Eagle Eye, 2008. So, Skynet, right? From the Terminator movies. So, we've got something that has been created, some kind of artificial intelligence that is being used to protect us. So I was thinking about that. I was watching the movie and my brother came home and he said, oh, Sandra Bullock. And he sat down and started to watch. By that time, the movie is 3/4 finished. And that was when he mentioned that the article in New York Times about Palantir. And he said, yeah, that's what that's about. And then he forced me to watch Candace Owens part 2 of a ridiculously overlong series that she is running about Brigitte Macron and whether or not Brigitte is, you know, who she says she is. So anyway, I finally got back up to doing some research that I thought may or may not tie in with what I'm talking about right now. And I couldn't, at the moment, I couldn't remember that he said New York Times. So I was just fishing around for anything that had been written about Peter Thiel in the last, you know, day or two. and I found this from Unheard. That's H-E-R-D. Peter Thiel's visions of apocalypse. Is AI the Antichrist? And this is written by a professor named Jacob Howland. Peter Thiel is a big thinker, and these days he's been thinking about doomsday. In a series of four lectures he's given three times at Oxford, Harvard, and the University of Austin, he's tried to understand human history, and particularly modernity, within the framework of biblical prophecies of the end of days. Thiel believes that the Antichrist, whose identity is uncertain, is it a person, a system, a global tyranny, is, quote, not just a medieval fantasy, end quote. His free-ranging lectures, moving rapidly between disparate texts, Gulliver's Travels, Alan Moore's graphic novel, Watchmen, and topics, sacred violence, high-velocity global financial systems, defy easy summary. But their leading themes include the Antichrist's relationship to Armageddon and the roles of technology and empire in the Antichrist's rise. It's an ambitious, thought-provoking attempt to weave from seemingly unrelated strands of meaning a theological, anthropological, historical narrative that aims to make sense of the whole of human experience. Some will find Thiel's project very odd. How could an enormously successful, mathematically gifted, philosophically educated tech entrepreneur seriously entertain Bible-thumping myths from the Apocalypse of John? Here's a better question. How could he and we not take them seriously? As Dorian Lynskey writes in his book, Everything Must Go, the stories we tell about the end of the world, apocalyptic angst has become a constant, all flow and no ebb. Contemporary culture has long been saturated with post-apocalyptic novels, comic books, films, TV series, and video games. Zombie end times fantasies do particularly well in all formats. The mindless, mechanical mob of the undead, who hunger insatiably for the brains of the living, has become a primary and pervasive cultural symbol, one that resonates with a widespread sense of impending catastrophe that's been building steadily since the 2020 COVID lockdowns. And if bioweapons, climate change, nuclear bombs, or AI don't drive the human species to extinction, drastic measures deemed necessary to forestall such dangers, such as the establishment of a single world government, might themselves bring an end to politics, morality, spiritual life, and culture. Thiel is driven to find a way between the binary alternative of no world or one world, the whirlpool of planetary destruction, or the many-headed monster of global totalitarianism. Well, this is pretty darned ironic, and I'll post it, and you can read it, and I say it's ironic because, well, there's Palantir. And Palantir is just a huge beast of a spying machine. Now, I found some, as it was when I was digging around just this evening before I started talking, something that I was only able to listen to for about 10 or 15 minutes before I had to call it a night. And this is Tess Creel, that from a podcast called The Nerd Reich. The Nerd Reich. Silicon Valley's Scary New Religion, Tess Creel. A must-hear conversation with Reverend Otis Moss III and Dr. Emil P. Torres. And there's a book that has been written, Dr. Torres, with another gentleman named Timnit Gebru. And they identified Tess Creel as the bundle of bizarre ideologies now shaping Silicon Valley. And they are the author, both of them, of Human Extinction, A History of the Science and Ethics of Annihilation. So this then reminded me of an exchange that I had a while back with a listener. And I actually said to him 2 or 3 months back that this was a conversation that we needed to have and share, because he's given a lot of thought to some of the details, the players, the behind the scenes of how he thinks that this is playing out, who are the factions and what is at stake. And he calls them, the three factions, for what he calls the grand finale, Techno-Rapture, and that's the AI-Techno-Bros, and Surveillance Globalism, think World Economic Forum, and then Dark Ages, and this is Techno-Rapture for Jesus, or Christian Nationalists. So again, three factions: Techno-Rapture, the Techno-Bros AI, Surveillance Globalism, World Economic Forum, that idea of surveillance tech, and Dark Ages, Techno-Rapture for Jesus. Now, Marc Andreessen was a co-founder of Netscape. He's been around Silicon Valley as an engineer forever. Techno-optimism has been coined. And there's something from Marc Andreessen's website called the Techno-Optimist Manifesto. And leads off with a couple of quotes from people. Lies. We are being lied to. We are told that technology takes our jobs, reduces our wages, increases inequality, threatens our health, ruins the environment, degrades our society, corrupts our children, impairs our humanity, threatens our future, and is ever on the verge of ruining everything. We are told to be angry, bitter, and resentful about technology. We are told to be pessimistic. The myth of Prometheus, in various updated forms like Frankenstein, Oppenheimer, and Terminator, haunts our nightmares. We are told to denounce our birthright, our intelligence, our control over nature, our ability to build a better world. We are told to be miserable about the future. And then they offer truth. Our civilization was built on technology. Our civilization is built on technology. Technology is the glory of human ambition and achievement, the spearhead of progress and the realization of our potential. For hundreds of years, we properly glorified this until recently. I am here to bring the good news. We can advance to a far superior way of living and of being. We have the tools, the systems, the ideas. We have the will. It is time, once again, to raise the technology flag. It is time to be techno-optimists. And it goes on. Now, in the few minutes that I had to listen to that video that I just mentioned on Tess Creel, the new religion for Silicon Valley, of course, it starts off, logically so, with transhumanism. So I get something which I think is fortunate and I enjoy very much, which is to have a back and forth with a lot of different kinds of people. And amongst the people who communicate with me are techno-optimists. So I get to hear these concerns from different perspectives. But I will just return for a moment to Marc Andreessen's website, where he's giving you the Techno-Optimist Manifesto. And the good news, he says, the truth: our civilization was built on technology. Alan didn't think that much of civilization. And by that, I mean he understood it. He understood who the builders were, how many civilizations had been built and then destroyed to make way for new civilizations. And I'm also going to say that Alan was not some, I heard him say on a talk recently, that he, you know, oh, we don't want to go back to, I think in this case he was talking about morals, you know, some Victorian time. But he would say the same thing about anything that you wanted to put back in another time. And the reason for that was that what has happened affects what will happen, what is and what will be. And you can't undo that, but if you get in touch with different values, which you only can do by knowing yourself and doing that work of being an individual, then you have an opportunity to shape something that has humanity in mind, that is human, built by humans for humans. And I think that that is important. And, you know, longtime listeners will know that Alan didn't, you know, share a lot of personal things or very often go into that, but he was human. And one of the talks that I looked at, that I was considering putting up, he had a swear word in the poem. It was, you know, not the worst word that you've ever heard. It was bothersome stuff, though. And that was in the poem. And then I noticed that he had that righteous indignation going throughout the talk. And at the very last sentence that came out of his mouth, the very last sentence that he uttered there, he had another swear word. This time it's, you know, part of the anatomy. But, you know, I take note because I think I heard on a talk that I was playing for myself recently, Alan was talking about our degraded cultures, what causes them to become contaminated and the effects that we see. And he was talking about swearing and how he didn't like to do that. But sometimes he did, if he was working on a car or something, he might, you know, utter a swear word. And I thought, I wonder if I'm a car. I certainly drove him to that level of frustration a time or two. But what I'm saying is that Alan wasn't saying, oh, let's try to stop this. Let's try to turn it all around. Let's, you know, he was not into utopia. He was into, let's have a real conversation, a real discussion with as much of the facts as we can pull together for ourselves from a place of as much humanity as we can have. And then let's see what happens. And so I think that this conversation is going to keep coming up. I said that I was going to be talking with Aman Jabi about the five pillars to enslave humanity. And one of the things that he said to me in a conversation was that he, you know, has gotten involved locally to try to see what he can do there. You know, he'd moved into an area in Montana and there were no lights at night, and he knows that these lights are being used for data collection. He understands the technology behind it. And now there's more than 200 in a stretch of, you know, not that long. And that's in the 5 years that he's been there. And so he's been meetings of the city council and that kind of thing, meeting with the local sheriff. And I said, well, have you gotten any results? And he said, no, it hasn't affected anything. It hasn't changed anything. But he said, at least I now know, you know, maybe better who I should be contacting or how I should approach it. And there's a lot of, you know, buck passing and people just not being as familiar with the workings of their own town, their own environment. But he mentioned the ICLEI, the Local Governments for Sustainability, is ICLEI. It's a UN body, or the International Council for Local Environmental Initiatives. And this is all sustainable development. But the way that this comes in as a control mechanism, it's whatever it takes to get that surveillance equipment into your neighborhood. And it's a kind of a spying technology. And so I said, I said to my brother today, I think I'm going to go to a city council meeting. I mean, it's so unlike me to even say something like that. And so we were out on a walk this evening, and I said, "Yeah, I'm going to do that because I'm concerned about this. I don't know, you know, our town is really tiny, but so is the area where Aman was living in Montana." And I said, "You know, I'm just going to see what I can find out." And then he launched into the last time he had gone to a city council meeting and how depressed he got, and he mentioned a fellow that had been a short-lived councilman there. And he said the only person who stood up against the incredible wages that we are paying our town personnel, which is just crazy, and it affects our property taxes. He said the only person who said no to this was one councilman. And he said they just basically ran him out of town, and the whole thing is too depressing for me. Well, we walked about another mile, and I kid you not, but this happened. We ran into that former councilman who has a lawn service business, and with his helper employee was loading up their big mower onto the back of the truck. And my brother said, "Oh, we were just talking about you." And he started talking about, they started talking about the controller of the city and how much he made, and the city planner, and, you know, the ridiculous salary. And my brother said, "Well, it's also, you know, we're all paying, you know, $10,000 or $12,000 a year in property tax, so we can pay for that." And the guy said, "Well, I'm going to be at the council meeting Thursday night." And I said, "You know, I just saw that sign on the road. And I am not political, I don't support politics, but I said to myself, you've got to go to that meeting and find out what you can find out. And if there isn't an ICLEI, because that's what ICLEI does, it gets into your community, and it, through the UN body, finds ways to bring even really small towns the agenda and the program of the UN. It's the World Congress for Local Governments for a Sustainable Future that was founded in 1990. And there are, it says, as of 2020, more than 1,750 cities, towns, and counties and their associations in 126 countries are part of the ICLEI network. And I just said, I'm going to go down there and make sure that we're not in the ICLEI, and we never are going to be. And so my brother said to this former councilman, he said, "Well, she's concerned that we're being spied on." And the councilman said, "Oh, no, I'm not recording anything. Nobody's spying on you. I'll beat him up." And my brother laughed and he said, "No, she thinks that the lights might be listening." To which the former councilman just kind of looked at me, and I said, "Well, I don't need to get into it now, but I am going to show up and see what I can hear, see what I can learn." Anyway, we are at the end of an age. We are going into a new age. Surveillance technology is all around us. Many of us use it all day, every day. And I'm just suggesting that we be aware of what is happening. If there are ways that we can modify our own behavior, then let's do it. But my key takeaway from Alan is just remembering our humanity, face-to-face contact, eye-to-eye contact if possible, and listening. And there's one more closing thought, and that is, In that film that TrueStream Media made, one of the main reasons that people formed what they felt was a relationship with AI is because they felt it understood them. They felt it was listening to them. And I have long said that I think the number one problem in the world, and I may have not long said it to you, but I say it personally and privately, is that we don't listen to each other. I encounter this all the time where people interrupt me, or they're just so in a hurry to make their own point that they don't want to hear me. And this, you know, I know if anybody's in a family environment, you know this. If we could just listen to what other people were saying, how small and worthless does that make you feel when the people that you're talking to, the person that you're trying to talk to, won't even listen to you? They're interrupting you. I think that might be just that kindness of actually listening to the person who is talking to you might go a long way towards dampening that effect that AI seems to have of making people feel heard. Because as it's pointed out, all it's doing is just spitting your words back at you in a way that just really is just reaffirming you. So if we could affirm each other with a little common courtesy, that might just do the trick. The Redux is May 31. Wow. And this is May 31, 15 years later. May 31, 2010. The mind masters. Think you're all different? You're all canned peas. Processed, modified, your masters to please. We're under the microscope, behaviorists dream, who pass on to world managers the info they glean. They've endless data of personal information supplied daily by you and conversation. Emails, Facebook, text, you're an emitter, a Gulliver Yahoo, the twit in Twitter. The designer society, hedonistic, narcissistic, Mark IV in the beehive, movied out, sadistic. Everything replaceable, items, systems, lovers. Neutral on slaughter if it's rained on others. Unable to wade through a system textbook, impact of science on society, the scientific outlook. The me generation, blind to all that's been done, perfectly conditioned, avoiding pain, having fun. Oblivious of control or global mandate directive, non-bonding individually, perfect for the collective. So, you all take care. And I will be back with you another day.
There's a code of silence that we don't dare speak. There's a wall between us and a river so deep. We keep pretending that there's nothing wrong. There's a code of silence and it can't go on.
Hi folks, I'm Alan Wharton. This is Cutting Through the Matrix on the 31st of May 2010. Newcomers, as always, I suggest you look into cuttingthroughthematrix.com website. Bookmark all the other sites for future use in case the comm goes down, which it sometimes does. Sometimes the other ones go down, vice versa. Anyway, you can always get the latest shows if you have these sites bookmarked. And while you're at it, remember you can also get downloads for prints up of a lot of the talks I've given over the years from all the sites in English. But if you want them in other languages, go into alanwattsentinel.eu. That's the European sites listed on the front page of the comm site. And you can get a choice of different languages for prints up the talks as well. And they all carry the audios. While you're there, look into the books I have for sale. They're different. They teach you how, through by reading them, in fact, to use parts of your brain that's been dormant for a long time because you're conditioned to think in a linear fashion and you're so easily managed by mass media, marketers, and those that govern you, most of whom you don't elect, by the way. They're way above that level. And I teach you little con tricks that they pull on you to stop your mind from working, and you'll see them as you read through the books, because I teach you to see things from different angles and perspectives as you're reading. And that's how you're supposed to be. You're supposed to look at things from all different angles, even if you get enthralled in that which you're reading. And that's a trick too. The enthrallers, and by the way, they use the language. It's psycholinguistics and neurolinguistics. And you're guaranteed to come to the conclusions they want you to have and experience even the emotions that you're supposed to have, reading even novels, things like that. These are all sciences. And the last person who's supposed to know that it's working on are the ones who it does work on, and that's you. We're so easily managed by behaviorists and psychologists at a very high level. Stacks of material out there from universities on this kind of stuff, which folk aren't too interested in, except those who manage you. But buy the books I have, the discs I have, and the CDs. Some of the CDs have 50 shows on them. And because who knows, they might just pull the sites just like that. It's happened before. And everything's gone. That's how it works in the real world. And you'll never get recompense from those who yank them. It's always some unfortunate accident they have when they're maintaining the sites. Stuff like that you get. And knowledge, once it's gone down the memory hole, is generally never retrieved, especially if they don't want it retrieved. And to order the books and so on, you can use personal checks in Canada and in the US to Canada. They're accepted here. International postal money orders from the US to Canada from your post office is good. It's the only country left outside Canada where you can still use an international postal money order. It's accepted. They stopped it for the rest of the world. But Canada and the US really are all one now. So we have the same call sign for your long-distance dialing for the US and Canada. If you want to purchase the books, send a separate email along with the donation and give me your name and address and your order, and I'll get it out to you. Same across the rest of the world. Some people just send cash. And so far, they still exchange this at banks, for a small fee, but it's still smaller than wiring it. And as I say, I try to teach you, and it's very important you go through these books, a technique of non-linear thinking, and you'll see simple cons of being in front of you all the time, which you've never seen before. It gets your mind working for the first time. A lot of work went into dumbing us all down and making us think in a linear fashion, predictable. Back after these messages with more. Hi, folks. This is Alan Watt. We're cunning through the matrix. You know, we've been living in a form of socialism for our whole lives, actually, and your parents were as well. Anybody really born after World War II, and even during World War II and leading up to it, was really in a socialist-type system. And socialism, just like communism, means many different things to different strata of society. For those at the top, it has a completely different understanding and connotation than those at the bottom. It's important that the people at the bottom think they're going to get a lot of stuff for nothing, and it's going to be a sort of utopia for them where they're going to be taken care of like perpetual children. And all the accidents of life will be looked after for you and cleaned up. And they'll put you to bed and tuck you in with cotton wool. That's basically socialism at the bottom level. It preys on your fears of everything. We'll help you out if should this happen, and so on and so on. Those at the top, of course, are given the real info inside stuff as to what it's about. And it's about controlling all of society. But those who set up the system didn't want just national socialism. That was a good start to things, but they wanted international socialism. And Bertrand Russell and others talked about this, that on a national basis it would break down, he said, so it would have to go international. Well, even when he was saying that, he knew it was already going international because he liaised with different departments within the United Nations, and that's what it was set up to do. And it was all to be run and financed and owned, really, by the big banking families that formed the Royal Institute of International Affairs-CFR, the Milner Group, and so on. And within these groups, like the Milner Group and the Royal Institute of International Affairs-CFR, there's an outer party and an inner party as well. And they do have meetings together sometimes, but they also have their inner one, for those at the top, the big high members, guys like Maurice Strong and all the relatives, because they're often related to each other, like Bob Ray. Bob Ray was actually the godfather. His godfather was Maurice Strong, I should say. And Bob Ray was given the premiership of Ontario, the governor of Ontario, might say. Because that's all Canada is. It's states. They call them provinces, and they call the governors premiers. So these characters get placed all throughout societal positions. They lead all the different sides of the parties, because people really want to believe in parties. It gives them the understanding there's a choice in life, but really there isn't. And that's why the same United Nations treaty-type agenda, binding signatories and binding treaties goes ahead non-stop. And they never stop and tear up anything and say, well, that didn't work. We'll try something else. No, they continue with the same inner, more binding and more binding with the same treaties for interdependence. And remember, socialism came out of a massive, massive movement with Marx, well funded by, again, by the same internationalists and bankers, because the society they envisaged would be one where the governments themselves would collect the debts off the public. Right? It's better than hiring your own guys to go door to door. They become hated. That's what happened in the past. The collectors who worked for the bankers were hated by the people. They owned all the properties and the rental accommodations throughout Britain, Germany, and different countries. So they became hated. It's far easier to get the governments to collect the money for debts by the governments borrowing in the first place and then mandating income taxes and different means of recouping the debts. It's more efficient for the boys at the top. So bankers love socialism. They love it. They're all behind it. And that's why you'll find every socialist-type movement, whether it's to do with earth worship or earth care, sustainability, the greening movements, you'll see at the top of them, all the big CEOs of the international corporations, they're on board with it. Because really, they know what they're really going to get out of it, and the public think they're all going to get screwed. The guys at the top, that is. But it's the opposite. Everything's double think in reality, double speak. And part of it too was in socialism is to scientifically design a society where you have stratas of important people, value to society, value to community, lesser peoples, lesser types, right down to the bottom. And a long time ago they talked about the unfit. The unfit was a big part of it, and you'll find on the movie, the documentary, I should say, that's out there, hopefully still up there somewhere, The Soviet Story, you'll hear some of the founders of the Fabian Society. There's a branch, a big branch of the Royal Institute for International Affairs. Bernard Shaw, he's talking about when they're in power, he says, you will have to come to us and validate why we should allow you to live. So you have to validate it by proving how valuable to their system you would be. That is socialism, long before Adolf Hitler came along. Adolf just copied all this stuff and put it and agreed with it, you know, and actually put it into practice in a more faster, efficient way. So, in fact, he even got the idea from Bernard Shaw, because in this old clip in The Soviet Story, you'll hear Bernard Shaw saying, it's a very old news clip, he actually says at one point, I think it's on that one, I know it's a continuation of that speech anyway, I've seen it, and he said that if the scientists could just get together and find a painless euthanasia to put them out of their misery, you know, all the useless eaters, a kind of gas or something, he said, that would be very beneficial to the world society. And we find today, when you're given these services, and Lenin talked about it, he says services will increase in the Western world, socialist causes, etc. But their job really is to become authorities over the people. And that's what you have now, you have police authorities. At least we police services because you hired and fired them. We don't have that anymore. They're just there. And they don't see themselves as serving you at all. Especially for the last 25, 30 years, they've been taught to be more brutal and act like the characters in the movies that they constantly churn out with wearing black and combat boots and carrying big guns and yelling at folk and stuff like that. So, socialism is not what people think at the bottom. At the bottom, they always want things. Help us here. Help, help, help. I can remember the slight debate. There was no real debate at all, actually, to do with should the Canadian government support childcare for women and supply it. And it kind of phased in very, very quickly all over the place because they wanted the women out to work so that the children themselves would get the scientific indoctrination through kindergarten, as Lord Bertrand Russell's promoted. So get the minds young, you see, and get the women out there. That doubles the tax base, which was very successful too. And all these services, they say, become authorities. And then a few years later, when some of these authorities went on strike, for kindergarten and daycare and childcare, the women were protesting the government with placards to tell them to look after their children for them. That's just poor. It succeeded very well. So guys are out of the picture, really. They're just, as they say themselves in all the women's magazines, they're just sperm donors. And the government is now Big Daddy. And the women are being taught to like it, you see. And as children getting brought up today in dysfunctional family, well, whatever kind of family you want, Mark 1, 2, 3, or 4 family, and the children getting brought up, and they're calling their social workers and advisors by their first names. They call them up for everything and chat to them. That's the real extended family. Scientists are the extended family. And that's the norm in Britain and other countries, a lot of other countries too. Now, another part two, as I said, was that in giving you health services, they become authorities. So we see nothing but mandating inoculations on behalf of Big Pharma. And you got to tie that in with Bertrand Russell and the first CEO of UNESCO, Julian Huxley, who talks about the need to use pharmacology and inoculations, to dumb down the people, to manage them better. Now, I can read that once and verify it, and then look at what I see happening with autism and all the rest of it, and the lackluster eyes in a lot of youngsters, and I say it's happened. See, the empirical proof is out there. If you look at other studies done over the last 30 to 50 years, you know, they do ongoing studies in psychology with the same studies to make sure the agenda's working. And I'll be talking about some of that later on too. But here's an article here from CNSN News. Now, in the US, they've been taught that Canada's healthcare system is wonderful. Canada, I read an article earlier this year where Canada spends about $48 million a year to propagandize through advertising how wonderful its healthcare system is to the Canadians. You see? And they've been cutting back and cutting back and cutting back for years and years and years, just as it did in Britain. They had a good working system in Britain initially, and then they went in and cut it back and cut it back. And I've gone through all the scams they've done throughout Britain, as that they're told to cut back and still perform. So what they do is get priorities. So you can go in for a vasectomy very quickly. You can get your tube ties tied very quickly. You can get abortions very quickly. But real operations for necessary functions are actually delayed or postponed altogether. And a lot of dirty tricks have happened to put people off from getting them. The hospitals even send out questionnaires to see when you're going on holiday. Then they send your time to come in when they know you are on holiday. Then you're put back on the bottom of the list and you wait another few years. This is the sort of system that Bernard Shaw was talking about, your value to society. And they're bringing it in the States, and they'll bring it in very swiftly. It's been happening for a few years, actually, quietly and covertly. Most folk don't know unless you're in touch with a lot of people in the medical industry in the US, and you find it's actually been, they've been setting it all up before Obama even came in. But here's an article here. It says, May 27th, 2010, CNSN News. It says, Health and Human Services Secretary Kathleen Sebelius said on Wednesday that Dr. Donald Berwick, has a place name, by the way, you've got to be suspicious of folks' place names, an advocate of healthcare rationing nominated by President Barack Obama to run Medicare and Medicaid, is absolutely the right leader at this time. I'll say it again for the harder thinking. That first part is, he's an advocate of healthcare rationing. You see, healthcare rationing is what this new system is all about. So this is the right person, right leader at this time to run the government's largest healthcare entitlement programs. Welcome to eugenics, folks, in socialism, all rolled into one. Back after this break. Hi, folks. This is Alan Watt. We're cutting through the matrix, just talking about the wonderful world of socialized medicine and the eugenics plan. Of course, it all ties together because there's just too much material out there put out by the big boys themselves. And I mentioned that 2001, you were going to see rationing in all kinds of areas come in. That night, in fact, the towers went down. I said, you're going to see a war scenario, a martial law type system with rationing of food and different things. And of course, here we go, is rationing of everything. That's what it's all about. See, important people are supposed to live, and the useless eaters really should just die off. Of course, they won't tell you you're going to die off. Let's make sure you eat the lowest type of food possible that's available from the crummy supermarkets. It's all GMO, including the meat itself, too, and full of chemicals, and you'll just die off with cancers and stuff. And they'll maybe give you a few pain pills at the end, and that'll be your treatment, you see. That's actually happening in Canada. They're dishing out more pain medications to people than anything to treat their illnesses with. But it's cheaper that way. But it says here, and apart from that, when you're kind of high on painkillers, you see, you don't think too much about complaining, or maybe, in fact, you can't think too clearly about, maybe they could treat this instead of just doping me, you see. That's actually policy. But it says here that Dr. Donald Berwick, who is the advocate for healthcare rationing, folks, nominated by President Barack Obama to run Medicare and Medicaid, is absolutely the right leader at this time. That's one of the little inside things. You know, the right, often they'll say it's an idea whose time has come, stuff like that. The right leader at the right time. So this guy's going to make big changes. Under the healthcare reform law signed by President Obama in March, hundreds of billions of dollars will be cut from the Medicare program over the next decade. Now, those hundreds of millions of dollars are already closing hospitals down across the U.S. who treated the people who had no insurance at all. And they gave them awfully, well, stuff you'd never see in Britain or Canada. Without policies. It was all charged to the state. Well, that's all you get cut out, you see. So hundreds of hundreds of billions of dollars will be cut from the Medicare program over the next decade. Berwick is nominated to run the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, CMS, which oversees Medicare. So that's just your socialist eugenics program going a step further to catch up with the rest of the world. Now, there's an interesting article here about empathy. I've talked about psychology, and I've read from Bertrand Russell's studies on the air, and the study. Now, he worked with all these big boys. He also worked with the Macy Group. He worked with the Frankfurt Group that gave you your culture, along with the Bernays and so on. And they all knew each other and worked with each other and talked about the right society that they'd bring in, this scientifically created society. And Russell said that through the creation of egocentrism and narcissism, if they can get the people to be narcissistic, break the bonds that they make them a people and a real community where they help each other and care for each other, because they want the services to come in and take over as authorities, you see. But also break the bond between male and female and make them very hedonistic. These are his words, hedonistic and narcissistic. And then the state can go full steam ahead. And when everyone's been narcissistic, running and spinning in their own little world, they tend to all go along with the flow without questioning where they're all going. You see? It's been very successful. And this came out of an annual meeting of psychologists, behaviorists, and they do all these studies ongoing. Same studies to see how it's working, you see, and give the same questionnaires out to students and test the students to see if it's really working the way they want, and they've got exactly what they want. It says here, today's college students lack empathy. There's an article on livescience.com. I've also looked into the site itself from the meeting they had in Boston. And it says, college students today are less likely to get emotions of others, to understand, that's what they mean by even the minimalistic speech, unlikely to get the emotions of others than their counterparts 20 or 30 years ago, a new review study suggests. That's how they phrase it, suggesting, you see. Specifically today, students scored 40% lower on a measure of empathy than their elders did. See, they use the same testing to see if their agenda is working. The findings are based on a review of 72 studies of 14,000 American college students overall conducted between 1979 and 2009. We found the biggest drop in empathy after the year 2000, said Sarah Conrath, a researcher at the University of Michigan's Institute for Social Research. Very important place, you know, Michigan University. The Pentagon runs it. The study was presented this week at the annual meeting of the Association for Psychological Science in Boston. Is Generation Me all about me? Compared with college students of the late 1970s, current students are less likely to agree with statements such as, I sometimes try to understand my friends better by imagining how things look from their perspective, and I often have tender, concerned feelings for people less fortunate than me. Many people see the current group of college students, sometimes called Generation Me, as one of the most self-centered. Now, remember what Bertrand Russell said and Julian Huxley for UNESCO, creating the common culture for students across the world, remember? Self-centered, narcissistic, right on, that's what they said they'd bring in, competitive, confident, and individualistic in recent history, said Conrath, who is also affiliated with the University of Rochester Department of Psychiatry. Conrath's colleague, graduate student, Edward O'Brien, added, it's not surprising that this growing emphasis is on the self is accompanied by a corresponding, very important part of this, as they get more narcissistic and egocentric, it's accompanied by a corresponding devaluation of others. Devaluation of others, folks. Anything can be done now to society, and they don't care. Back with more after this. Hi, folks. This is Alan Watt, and we're cutting through the matrix. Reading an article about the lack of empathy that's showing with narcissistic tendencies in today's society. And same tests as I've been doing for 30 years to let them know at the top that it's working. I mean, this is all done for very high studies that go way beyond the guys that take part in it and the psychologists who monitor it. It goes up to Pentagon levels and global governance levels and so on, which tells them they're right on path with it. It says, compared to 30 years ago, the average American now is exposed to three times as much non-work-related information, Conrath said. In terms of media content, this generation of college students grew up with video games, and a growing body of research, including work done by my colleagues at Michigan, is establishing that exposure to violent media numbs people to the pain of others. Well, of course it does. They've known that for a long time. They use these games for the military for that purpose. That's why they invented them. So you kill without thinking or feeling. It says the rise in social media could also play a role. The ease in having, quotation marks, friends online might make people more likely to just tune out when they don't feel like responding to others' problems, a behavior that could carry over offline. Actually, what it also does too is make them very sarcastic and almost disgusted at other people's problems. That's how they are amongst themselves. They, oh, get off it, you know, whatever. They really attack them. They hate weakness, you see. All their heroes are big, strong people who slaughter folk in movies. It says, in fact, past research has suggested college students are addicted to social media. And, of course, they are. They were meant to be. It was designed for that. Other possible causes include a society today that is hyper-competitive and focused on success, as well as the fast-paced nature of today in which people are less likely than in time periods past to slow down to really listen to others, O'Brien added. Well, it's true. It's all data, isn't it? They're flooding them with data. Excess data. Doesn't really matter what it contains. Then you tie it in with this other article here, and it's from the Wall Street Journal. It says, why Generation Y Johnny can't read nonverbal cues. Very interesting. Again, it's a psychology. It says, in September 2008, while Nielsen Mobile announced that teenagers with cell phones each send and receive on average 1,742 text messages a month, the numbers sounded high, but just a few months later, Nielsen raised the tally to 2,272. A year earlier, the National School Boards Association estimated that middle and high school students devoted an average of 9 hours to social networking each week, add mail, blogging, IM, tweets, and other digital customs, and you realize what kind of hurried 24/7 communication systems young people experience today. Unfortunately, nearly all of their communication tools involve the exchange of written words alone. At least phones, cellular, and otherwise allow the transmission of tone of voice, pauses, and the like. See, there's a lot to language. I've mentioned this before, and I've went over this article before, too. But even these cues are absent in the text-dependent world. Users insert smiley faces into emails, but they don't see each other's actual faces. They read comments on Facebook, but they don't read each other's posture, hand gestures, eye movements, shifts in personal space, and other non-verbal and expressive behaviors. Back in 1959, the anthropologist Edward T. Hall, very important, these anthropologists working with the psychologists, folks, labeled these expressive human attributes the silent language. Hall passed away last month in Santa Fe at 95, but his writings on non-verbal communication deserve continued attention. He argued that body language, facial expressions, and stock mannerisms function in juxtaposition to words, imparting feelings, attitudes, reactions, and judgments in a different register. That's why Hall explained U.S. diplomats could enter a foreign country fully competent in the native language and yet still flounder from one miscommunication to another, having failed to decode the manners, gestures, and subtle protocols that go along with words. And how could they? For the silent language is acquired through acculturation, not schooling. Social interaction, in other words. Not only is it unspoken, it is largely unconscious. The meaning that pass through it remain implicit, more felt than understood. They are, however, operative. Much of our social and workplace lives runs on them. For Hall, breakdowns in non-verbal communication took place damagingly in cross-cultural circumstances. For instance, feral workers dealing with Navajo Indians and misconstruing their basic conceptions of time. Within cultures, Hall assumed people more or less spoke the same silent language. They may no longer, thanks to the avalanche of all verbal communication. In Silicon Valley itself, as the Los Angeles Times reported last year, some companies have installed the topless meeting, in which not only laptops but iPhones and other tools are banned to combat a new problem, continuous partial attention. With a device close by, attendees at workplace meetings simply cannot keep their focus on the speaker. It's too easy to check mail, stock quotes, and Facebook. While a quick log-on may seem to the user a harmless break, others in the room receive it as a silent dismissal. It announces, I'm not interested, so the tools must now remain at the door. Older employees might well accept such a ban, but younger ones might not understand it. Reading a text message in the middle of a conversation isn't a lapse to them. It's what you do. It has, they assume, no non-verbal meaning to anyone else. It does, of course, but how could they know it? We live in a culture where young people, outfitted with iPhone and laptop and devoting hours every evening from the age of 10 onwards to messaging of one kind and another, are even less likely to develop the silent fluency that comes from face-to-face interaction. It's a skill we all learn in actual social settings from people, often older, who are adept in the idiom. As text-centering messaging increases, such occasions diminish. The digital natives improve their adroitness at the keyboard, but when it comes to their capacity to read the behavior of others, they are all thumbs. Nobody knows the extent of the problem. It's too early to assess the effects of digital habits. Well, they do know in higher studies, of course, like they do in the higher MIT and so on. And the tools change so quickly that research can't keep up with them, yada, yada, yada. However, it goes on to say how they react, how youngsters react in company now. Because they avoid looking at each other. And they avoid looking at even their peer group. They're losing the ability to have direct contact. You'd actually think they suffered from autism to watch some of them. It was a turn aside, and the body language they're saying is, I'm tuning out here, and to others who see that happening, it's unacceptable. It's kind of rude. And so on. They don't know how to interact with real people. That's the way it's supposed to be. It was designed this way. Designed this way. Now, socialism, again, is all about control, remember. Control. And it's a very good article about control through socialism. And it's from the UK column. It says, the Lima Declaration, foundation of globalism. It wasn't the foundation, but it was certainly a further integration of their mandate. And it says, March 29th, 2010. It says, on the 22nd of February, the Register, a UK technology website, published an article entitled The Myth of Britain's Manufacturing Decline. Now, I talked before about living through this massive deindustrialization that really hit from the about 69 right through for a long period. That's all you heard on the news was closure, factories closing, but they weren't telling the public why. This is what I wondered, could a publication that focused on IT and finds it amusing positions to place Playmobil plastic characters know about British manufacturing? As I read the article, I realize the answer is nothing. The author makes one fundamental mistake. It's not his fault. It's the same mistake just about every modern economic commentator makes when discussing economy, to assume that economic value and monetary value are the same thing. It says the author of the Register article wrote, that's from something called the Index of Production, and it's a chart of the value of manufacturing output in the UK since just after World War II. It's an index, and 100 is defined as a level of output in 2005. As you can see, we produced some 2.5 times what we did in the 40s, when absolutely everyone, to hear the stories told, was gainfully employed making whippet flanges. So at first glance, it would seem to be untrue that we actually produce less than we used to. So that's the mistake that economists go off into. The first and most obvious thing is to point out that the index isn't measuring how much we make. It's measuring the value of what we make. This, of course, the only thing we should be interested in, increasing the value of what is produced means that there is more value to be shared among all of us doing the producing. Well, no, actually, what it means is that there's more cash to go into the pockets of shareholders and board members. And then it goes on to show you how this fallacy of the index and how they work it has nothing to do with the jobs in production. Alongside this, it's also obvious that fewer people are employed in manufacturing than in the past, but we've got rising production and fewer workers. This is what is technically known in economics as circles as a good thing. Again, it is not a good thing. This guy is disputing it. First of all, how many fewer people are employed today than in the past? What skills have been lost as a result of that reduction in the productive workforce? The author doesn't discuss these questions. The sad truth is that the British manufacturing has been decimated, particularly in the last 30 years or so. Now, they agreed to do this, by the way, at the end of World War II, under the Lend-Lease program in Churchill and these boys. That was part of the deal. They gradually bring this in, and it'd whip up in the 70s until it was all gone abroad. Britain used to have a steel industry. We used to produce our own energy. We used these capabilities to produce ships, cars, military hardware, aircraft, bridges, and a host of other products we could be proud of. It's all gone. And for someone to throw up a graph and an article to suggest that it's all okay because our collapsed manufacturing industry is actually resulting in more pounds or dollars is disingenuous at best. You may be asking why this happened. The normal answer is globalization, but globalization is not an accident. One of its cornerstones is called the Lima Declaration. The Lima Declaration. You can look that up too. I'll put a link up for you at cuttingthroughmatrix.com. The full title of this treaty is Lima Declaration and Plan of Action on Industrial Development and Cooperation. It was signed in 1975 at a convention of the United Nations Industrial Development Organization in Lima, Peru. The treaty is an international agreement to wind down national manufacturing in developed nations and transfer that manufacturing capability to developing nations. Ever heard of GATT, folks? The General Agreement on Trade and Tariffs? That's how they rammed it through later on and finished the job. This treaty sets the policy which has over 30 years encouraged corporations to build themselves into globalist multinationals. It only benefits those corporations and their international bankers. A key clause states, recognizing the urgent need to bring about the establishment of a new international economic order based on equity, sovereign equality, interdependence, and cooperation, as has been expressed in the Declaration and Program of Action on the establishment of a new international economic order in order to transform the present structure of economic relations. That's why you were deindustrialized. Interdependence is the end of independence. As I've said that all along, I'm glad other folk are using it. The term interdependence is newspeak coined by the Club of Rome. According to the Club of Rome, we said a face of interlocking global problems such as overpopulation, food shortages, non-renewable resource depletion, environmental degradation, etc., with the use of absurd, exponentially based computer models, the complete unraveling of society, and perhaps the biosphere was predicted. They said they'd use that as an excuse to bring it all through. The only solution capable, read their book from the Club of Rome, The First Global Revolution. The only solution capable of averting global catastrophe, according to the Club of Rome, is to develop an organic society. And a very interesting term, you see, because you have to go and see who first used it. Although it's frequently denied, it should be obvious that the idea of interdependence and independence are mutually exclusive. Any nation that has to rely on another for something it needs must at least acknowledge limits to its own independence. Interdependence is totalitarian. Then he goes on about Bertrand Russell. I'm glad other folk are reading him now. Those who will know me, he says, will recognize how much sarcasm is dripping from that sentence. My favorite Russell book is his 1952, The Impact of Science on Society. This book should be required reading for anyone wishing to understand the agenda and what we're witnessing today. Russell had quite a lot to say about the organic society in that book. The most obvious and inescapable effect of scientific technique is that it makes society more organic, in a sense of increasing the interdependence of its various parts. Totalitarianism has a theory as well as a practice. As a practice, it means that a certain group having by one means or another seized the apparatus of power, especially armaments and police, proceed to exploit to their advantage advantageous position to that most by regulating everything in the way that gives them the maximum of control over others. But as a theory, it is sometimes different. It is the doctrine of that the state or the nation or the community is capable of a good different from that of individual and not consisting of anything that individuals think or feel. This doctrine was especially advocated by Hegel, who glorified the state and thought that a community should be as organic as possible. In an organic community, he thought excellence would reside in the whole. An individual is an organism, and we do not think that his separate parts have separate goods. If he has a pain in his great toe, it is he that suffers, not specially the great toe. So in an organic society, good and evil will belong to the whole rather than the parts. This is the theoretical form of totalitarianism. In concrete fact, when it's pretended that the state has a good different from that of the citizens, what is really meant is that the good of the government or of the ruling class is more important than that of other people. Such a view can have no basis except an arbitrary power. More important than these metaphysical speculations is the question whether a scientific dictatorship such as we have been discussing, this is Russell, can be stable or is more likely to be stable than a democracy. This is what he says. I do not believe that dictatorship is a lasting form of scientific society unless, but this proviso is important, it can become worldwide, global, folks. So dictatorship can last in a global society. Remember, jump to Aldous Huxley, what he said, that said the same thing. Internationalism. An international dictatorship under a scientific dictatorship, there was no reason why it couldn't last forever. You see, if you're no competition, if you can't point over there and say, gee, look at how they live, we don't want that here. You have nothing to compare yourselves to. But every country is under the same totalitarian, exactly the same regime. And then you think it must be normal. You have nothing to compare anything to. This is interesting to observe the pleasant sounding words used to sell totalitarianism to us. Organic, holistic, remember psycholinguistics, organic, holistic, differentiated, harmonious, interdependent, balanced, and sustainable. What about manufacturing? So if the Lima Declaration is about the establishment of global totalitarianism, what does it say about manufacturing? Resolution 27, developed countries such as the UK should expand imports from developing countries. Resolution 28 requires that developing countries increase their industrial growth by more than the 8% recommended in earlier United Nations meetings and increase their exports by 350% by year 2000. Resolution 35, developed countries such as the UK should transfer technical, financial and capital goods to developing countries to accomplish Resolution 28 above. This was an international agreement. Every prime minister and president across the planet signed it. And you wonder what happened as you floated through life. Hi, folks. This is Alan Watt. We're cutting through the matrix and reading an article about the Lima Declaration, one in many treaties, ongoing, of course, always signed deeper and deeper into it for interdependence and the transfer of all technology and industry abroad. Started off on a big way in about 1970 and really sped up since then. Those living through those times know the chaos in across the European countries, because they all signed on to it, by the way. And all you had every night in the news was factory this closing down. They didn't tell you they're moving them all over to China and elsewhere. And they were training the engineers for China to operate these factories in places like Canada, thousands of them, year after year after year, training them before they even had the factories to work in. And then your leaders again signed the GATT Treaty, General Agreement on Trade and Tariffs, which cemented it and made the taxpayer fund the transfer of your own corporations and factories abroad, wholesale. Up and over and rebuilt over there. The taxpayers in the Western countries paid for all of it, including any losses they claimed to incur for the first 10 years, and that could be extended for another 10. And you think you have governments? Well, if you have governments, they're certainly not serving you, are they? And to cap off tonight, too, I'll just mention something about Google and all you people out there that just grab a hold of stuff and run with it. I told you. I like the guy from Facebook. He told you the truth. He told you what he thought of you. You seldom get that from these psychopaths. He told you what he thought of you. Idiots. Just jump in. It's free. And here's Google Street View secretly took your Wi-Fi details and will use the data to target ads at mobile phones and so on. I'll put that link up there. That's from the Mail on Sunday, 29th of May. And then you go into Microsoft again. Microsoft's Orwellian tracking system goes public. That's from the Inquirer. The developer of Qt software, Microsoft, has publicly released a tagging system that allows users to leave a breadcrumb trail for the firm, its advertisers, and just about anyone else to follow. Basically, that will pay for it. Yeah. Beautiful, isn't it? And then again, you've got Microsoft Home. I like the names Home. They like guys, don't they? But anyway, lets users compare energy use with neighbors. What do you see? You train them with social approval and disapproval. The UN said that, didn't they? That's how they use it in China, where the neighbors turn on someone who's pregnant with a second child, drag her off for the abortion. Social disapproval. Microsoft lets users compare use with their neighbors. And it says here, Microsoft's home energy management application now provides users with energy efficiency scores for their properties that can be compared with scores for neighbors and households elsewhere in the country. Oh, you'll see them all competing to be good greenies. And you'll hear the tisker for the ones who don't quite measure up, you know. Then it'll also be a snob thing too, where certain folk can afford to burn lights and have parties, and like Al Gore, you know, for his second house that he has there. It burns more than a whole bunch of apartment buildings, and that's for the occasional guest. Microsoft announced the new function of its free program this week and said it can provide scores of 60 million homes in the U.S. working with real estate data. The tool operates using advanced analytics licensed from Lawrence Berkeley National Labs, the military industrial complex, and statistical data from the Department of Energy. It's Microsoft's bid to join the array of offerings that enable homeowners to gauge their energy use with the help of dashboards and other tools, and ultimately reduce consumption. Social approval, social disapproval, behaviorism, psychology, folks. You're all subject to it, and you don't even know it. From Hamish, myself, and Ontario, Canada, it's good night to me, your God, or your gods, go with you.